This is a Charles Russell Speechlees podcast.
Welcome to Property Patter, slightly remote. I am joined today by Lauren Fraser and Laura Bushaway of our Real Estate Disputes team. We'll be examining the changing landscape in residential leasehold and the private rented sector. Hello both, very nice to see you. It's been over 3 years since the government published its white paper on the housing market in England. Since then, we've seen proposals for dramatic change in the residential sector coming from all sides. It must be very hard, I think, for interested parties to stay on top of all of the developments. So what are we doing to help our clients stay informed? Lauren, perhaps you'd like to start.
Well, hi, Emma. There are so many changes being discussed which will have an enormous impact on our clients' businesses. We've always published regular updates about legal developments and keep track of what's coming down the pipeline. But the pace of consultations and other papers published by the Law Commission and the government over the past few years has been so fast, we thought it would be useful to do something more and produce a tool which would give an overview of the changes and a clear picture of what those changes mean.
So we've got a new initiative that we're launching, and it's a hub called Essential Residential, and that incorporates a timeline feature on the changing landscape of residential leasehold and the evolution of the private rented sector. And this enables users of the hub to track the government's proposals and those of the Law Commission from 2017 to date. And the timelines will also include key future dates so that users can anticipate the forthcoming changes which are continuing to take place.
The hub itself will also host all of our usual insights in an easy to use format. So it's going to be a resource which can be referred back to whenever you feel all of the changes are getting overwhelming.
Lovely. So a sort of one stop shop for all the residential information, both historic, as it were, and current, and then coming up. Love it. There's been a lot of coverage in the press about concerns regarding leasehold properties and what's been happening to date. What has been happening? What are we expecting to see?
So leasehold as a system has been under fire, and perhaps unfairly, for decades. And the recent controversy surrounding doubling ground rents and leasehold houses means the government's focus is firmly fixed on reforming the residential leasehold sector. Whilst attention is understandably elsewhere at the moment, we're anticipating 3 reports from the Law Commission to be published at the end of May on enfranchisement, right to manage and common hold.
Yes, they've been busy, or they are being busy. The general complaint when it comes to enfranchisement is that it's complicated and expensive. I mean, that's a fair summary, isn't it?
Well, as an enfranchisement practitioner myself, I find the complexities make it a really interesting area of law. However, even I will accept that there are certain aspects which could be refined to make the procedure more straightforward. The Law Commission's proposals include introducing a single scheme for residential units rather than having separate legislation for flats and houses, simplifying the qualifying criteria for bringing a claim, and removing some of the parts of the legislation which can lead to some interesting disputes between leaseholders. So, for example, at the moment, the threshold for participating tenants in a collective enfranchisement claim is 50% of the qualifying tenants in a building, and there is no requirement to invite all of the qualifying tenants to join in. So this means in a building of 10 flats, it's completely possible for a faction of 5 leaseholders to deliberately leave the others out when bringing their claim. But once the first 5 have acquired the freehold, there's nothing to stop the other 5 from immediately bringing their own claim and buying it back. The Law Commission has proposed that there should be a new right for non-participating tenants to purchase a share in the freehold company at a later date, and said that no further claim can be made for 5 years once the collective claim is concluded, in an attempt to stop that sort of funny business.
That's really interesting, Lauren, all the stuff about the shenanigans that goes on. I think, is it fair to say we know the most important aspect of an enfranchisement claim to anyone involved is the price? Are there any plans for changes on that side?
Yes, naturally, what people are going to pay and receive for these sorts of claims are of great interest to the parties involved. So what's happened there is the government has tasked the Law Commission to come up with proposals to reduce the premiums payable by leaseholders and a report on that topic was published in January this year. There's an undeniable conflict set by this objective, and so the Law Commission has sought leading counsel's opinion on the human rights aspect of this proposal. Their conclusion was that the right to compulsorily acquire the freehold or extend the lease of a house or flat interferes with a landlord's property rights under the European Convention on Human Rights, and so it will only be lawful if the landlord is sufficiently compensated to justify interference with those property rights.
So where that leaves us is that the Law Commission's report in January effectively gave the government a menu of starters, main courses and desserts, if you like. However, the final meal, and by analogy, the precise valuation basis, will depend upon what the government decides to select. I think what is clear is that there could be significant changes to the valuation basis and to the enfranchisement process as a whole.
Another area on which there's been a lot of focus is common hold, and there have been some suggestions that this form of tenure should be the way forward. Lauren, perhaps you wouldn't mind explaining what common hold actually is and what the government's proposals are.
So common hold is a type of freehold land which offers an alternative to leasehold. It was introduced originally in September 2004, and despite turning sweet 16 this year, take-up remains very low. It's estimated there are less than 50 properties with a common hold setup. However, in March 2019, the Housing, Communities and Local Government Select Committee produced a report in which they advocated that common hold should be the main ownership model for flats in England and Wales. The trouble is there is a reason why there's been limited take-up. The current system is unattractive for developers and lenders, and the Law Commission report proposes an enormous overhaul of the system to change this. The main challenge is that common hold by its nature is intended to be a uniform, simple system so that it's easier for home buyers to understand. The problem with this is it means it lacks flexibility, so it's hard to adapt it for modern developments. So the Law Commission is trying to find a way to strike a balance, which they'll need to do if they want to make common hold more common.
Well, that's really interesting. It certainly sounds like the Law Commission is very busy at the moment. What can we expect from the government in 2020?
So some of the really significant proposals for leasehold were put forward in June 2019 when the Ministry of Housing, Communities and Local Government published its response to the consultation implementing reforms to the leasehold system in England. We haven't seen any legislation yet, as Parliament has had some other demands on its time, but the proposals are likely to have a really significant impact on the sale of new houses and the grant of new leases of houses and flats. Firstly, there's going to be a ban on the sale of new leasehold houses, so that all new houses must be sold freehold except in very limited circumstances. This will apply to all sales from the date the legislation comes into force in relation to freehold land. In some cases, the land on which the new house is built will be leasehold rather than freehold, but the new house can't be sold as leasehold unless the leasehold land was acquired prior to the date of the original announcement on the 22nd of December 2017. If a new house is sold on a leasehold basis after the ban comes into force, the leaseholder will be entitled to buy the freehold at no cost as a zero cost enfranchisement. There's no limitation period on such claims, and there will be powers contained within the legislation to introduce civil penalties as a means of enforcement against those selling new houses as leasehold rather than freehold. So some pretty tough measures being anticipated there.
Okay, so lots of interesting stuff there. What other changes are coming?
Well, the other dramatic change being proposed is abolishing ground rents for new leases. Apparently, the government's initial proposal to cap ground rent at £10 per annum didn't go far enough. There'll be no transitional period with this. The ban will apply from the date the legislation comes into force. So any existing leases granted before the legislation is enacted won't be caught by these reforms, except where the existing lease is surrendered and regranted. In cases where a landlord and tenant agree a voluntary lease extension, zero ground rent will apply to the new extended part of the lease only, so that the existing ground rent is chargeable until the expiry date of the original lease.
Okay, so that's interesting on the leasehold side. Obviously, with some freeholds, there are estate charges and things like that. Is there anything in mind from the government to deal with those?
Yes, Emma. On a freehold estate, freeholders of individual houses, as you say, are often required to pay estate charges in respect of the services provided to the estate. And what the government is thinking is giving a freeholder the right to challenge the reasonableness of those estate charges and apply to the tribunal to appoint a manager over the estate. And this is a right that leaseholders of flats already have at the moment.
The government is also considering bringing in the right to manage for freeholders who own properties on an estate after the Law Commission separately reported to the government on wider proposals to reform the existing statutory right to manage, which Lauren mentioned earlier.
So, okay, well, that will be interesting. Watch this space. Building safety, of course, is also very high on the government's agenda. Laura, what developments are we going to see on that side?
This has been an area which has been high on the government's agenda since the tragic events of Grenfell in June 2017. The Hackett report was published in June 2018, which recommended a new regulatory framework for high-rise residential buildings. In June 2019, the government issued an extensive consultation entitled Building a Safer Future: Proposals for Reform of the Building Safety Regulatory System. And in that, it sought views on what it described as proposals for a radically new building and fire safety system. And the government has very recently published its response to that consultation.
Interesting. Okay. And what are the headlines for our listeners contained in the government's response?
Well, one of the first announcements was that the government is looking to establish a new national building safety regulator as part of the Health and Safety Executive, and they'll be responsible for implementing and enforcing a more stringent regulatory regime for certain buildings and safety and performance of other buildings. There is going to be a new system of duty holders and gateways, and basically a building is going to have to pass through a series of gateways when it is being constructed to make sure that at each stage it meets the relevant thresholds. Once new buildings are occupied, and this will also apply to existing buildings, there will then be an accountable person for each building who will be responsible for understanding fire and structural risk and managing those risks. For existing buildings, this is likely to be the freeholder or the landlord who administers rent and service charges. Existing buildings over 18 metres or six storeys will fall within the more stringent regime, and there will be a transitional period for existing buildings to comply. We will know more about that later in the year when the government publishes its proposals on that. Residents will also have rights to receive certain safety information about their buildings, but they will also be required to cooperate and avoid doing anything which could pose a risk to fire and structural safety of the building. Much of the detail behind these proposals will be contained within the Building Safety Bill, which has not yet been published, so we will know more when that becomes before Parliament.
Okay, so is there anything else we can expect?
Yes, the government has recently published the Fire Safety Bill, which is going to extend existing legislation in relation to fire safety to multi-occupied residential buildings, including the building's structure, external walls and common parts, including individual flat entrance doors. The government has also created funds for the replacement of unsafe cladding. In May 2019, it announced £200 million for private sector residential buildings over 18 metres, and that's for the replacement of aluminium composite material cladding, which is known as ACM cladding. And in the recent budget, it announced a further £1 billion for the removal and replacement of non-ACM cladding systems. This includes high-pressure laminate, wood and other cladding types from both private and social housing. So I think there are lots of developments on the horizon in this area.
Okay, so yes, as you say, lots of developments on the horizon, and particularly changes in the pipeline as far as building safety is concerned. And I guess once the legislation is published, we'll be able to understand more about how some of those measures are going to work in practice, particularly relating to the ownership and management of existing buildings.
What changes, Lauren, are we likely to see in the private rented sector?
Well, the main change on the horizon is the government's plan to abolish Section 21 of the Housing Act 1988 and short-hold tenancies. The majority of short-term tenancies granted in England of residential property are ASTs or assured short-hold tenancies. So this reform will have a really widespread impact.
Okay, so what's the government actually looking to achieve?
The government wants to give greater security to residential tenants, but obviously these proposals have caused some concern amongst landlords. They're going to have some high additional hurdles to cross to get possession of their properties when they need them. For example, if a tenant fails to leave at the expiry of the notice, landlords are worried that the procedure for getting a possession order through the courts could be convoluted and delayed. We don't believe that the changes will be retrospective, so they'll only apply to new tenancies created after the legislation comes into force. We're waiting for the government to provide a response to a consultation that it ran on how to implement the changes towards the end of last year, and then we'll get to see the draft legislation.
So how will a landlord be able to seek possession of a property if the government's changes are introduced?
If assured short-hold tenancies are abolished, most tenancies will be granted then as assured tenancies, and a landlord would need to establish one of the grounds for possession under Section 8 of the Housing Act 1988, such as arrears of rent or a breach of the tenancy.
Okay, and what do you think is the likely impact of proposals?
As a firm, we responded to the government's consultation and inputted into the government's proposals, drawing some of the potential unintended consequences to the attention of the policymakers. If the government decide to press ahead with the abolition of Section 21 and ASTs, we will need to wait for the legislation to fully assess the impact of the proposals. But having analysed the government's proposals so far, there could be some unintended consequences which the government may need to give some further thought to. For example, the government has suggested that it is possible for a landlord and tenant to agree for a break clause to be included within a new tenancy, which can be terminated without the landlord needing to rely on any ground for possession. Due to the technical operation of the legislation concerning assured tenancies, we think that that's actually not correct. So the government may need to give some further thought to that. Otherwise, a landlord will always have to establish a ground for possession in order to seek possession of the property. I think there's also question marks over the impact of the proposals on the availability of rental properties, as landlords may wish to divest itself of investment properties because of the additional complexities of the proposals. There could also be some resourcing considerations that are necessary because the changes could lead to an increase in court proceedings in order to establish a statutory ground for possession. And this may in turn place an additional pressure on the court system which hears possession claims. Finally, the government has also been increasing its efforts to tackle rogue landlords and letting agents, and there have been a number of initiatives which they've implemented, including giving additional funding to local authorities who are responsible for enforcing the legislation and creating a rogue landlord database to join up between local authorities action being taken against particular rogue landlords. The government is focused on rogue landlords and letting agents, but some feel that there needs to be more focus on that element rather than increasing regulation over the landlord's ability to obtain possession of tenancies. But we will have to wait and see what happens.
Okay, well, thanks very much for that, Laura. That's very interesting, and it'll be really interesting to see what the impact is when we get some more detail. There's obviously plenty in the pipeline. Today has been a real whistle-stop tour of the changes. Thank you to you both. The landscape of residential property is obviously continually evolving. And as you have heard at the start of the podcast, essential residential is a tool which allows everyone to stay ahead of the curve. As a firm, we act for urban estates, house builders, and a range of other stakeholders in the residential and mixed use property industry. So we're very well placed to identify and advise on the potential impact of these reforms. But if you would like to know more, there will be details on the website, or you can find any of our details on LinkedIn. But for now, it just remains for me to thank you as our listeners for bearing with us during these slightly more challenging times. I hope you forgive any interruption in sound quality. I'd like to thank Lauren and Laura very much for their time. I would also like to really thank Stuart Smith of our business development team, who has persevered with us in making these changes in how we affect the recordings, and will hopefully make us sound a bit slicker than we sound in our own ears at present. So thank you all. Stay safe and well.
Thanks for having us, Emma.
Thanks, Emma.
This is a Charles Russell Speechleys podcast.